I'm Marty Moscoane. Welcome to Radio Times. Michael Botticelli, the new acting director of the White House's Office of National Drug Control Policy, wants to bring a more public health approach to the problem of substance abuse. Instead of arresting and incarcerating everyone caught using illegal drugs, he says that treatment is a more effective and less costly approach. Botticelli worked in public health in Massachusetts before coming to the White House office, where he first served as deputy director. He brings his own personal experiences to his job as a recovering alcoholic. We asked him to talk with us about what he wants to accomplish as the nation's acting drug czar, as this job is often called, and he joins us from the White House. Michael Botticelli, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good morning, Marty. It's really a pleasure to be here.
Nice to have you with us. And what are you going to do about this title, acting drug czar or drug czar? Are you stuck with it?
I hope I'm not stuck with it. I think, you know, the title of drug czar, I think, really kind of connotes a militaristic view of how we're dealing with our drug issue. And, you know, I think our policy has changed dramatically. And certainly my own personal experience and my professional experience, I think it's really not an apt title, both from a policy and a personal perspective.
Well, I'd like to talk a bit about your personal experiences, because I think it's so unusual for this job. Reading about you, you were a pretty active and florid alcoholic. You came from a family of alcoholics and began drinking in high school.
The interesting piece about my story, Marty, is that it's actually not a unique story. And, I grew up in a family like many families in the United States that had addiction in its family. You know, I don't think I've met a family yet that hasn't had some level of addiction. And, you know, I like many, started drinking at an early age, and that continued through college and into my early adulthood. And I look back at my own experience, and it really points to where we're significant. So we know that substance use disorders are entirely preventable. And I look back at my own story and the experience of countless other people who are in recovery and really say, what were the missed opportunities? What were the systemic failures from a public health and a medical standpoint that we could have done a better job at intervening in my life and the lives of so many other Americans? So it really does provide for me an opportunity from a policy perspective to say, where do we really need to continue to evolve our drug policy in the United States so that we are preventing substance use disorders, that where we are intervening and providing treatment and providing an atmosphere that diminishes the guilt and shame that so often keeps parents and people asking for help when they know that they have a problem.
A couple of follow-up questions, though, about your life, and then we'll move on to policy, because you did get into a car accident. You ended up in the hospital. You have a record because of your accident. But even after that, you continue to drink. And I ask this because about the power of denial when it comes to addiction.
You raise some really, I think, poignant points. And so one of the hallmarks that come with addiction is that people do things in spite of the negative consequences that they've experienced in their life. And as you point out, and as I kind of lived it, you go through a tremendous amount of denial and rationalization about your own life. And so even when I look back around my own issues, that despite the fact that I was in a pretty significant car accident, that I was arrested, that I was in significant financial distress to the point where I was getting calls from credit card collectors, I was getting eviction notices, that you continue to do that behavior in spite of the negative consequences. And so it's very, very telling for me kind of what we really need to do to be able to break through this. And you know, it really wasn't until I got to the point where I finally acknowledged that I had a problem that I was really able to, unfortunately, get help for my disease.
And did that happen truly in a bar? You met another alcoholic, or perhaps even recovering alcoholic, and that began your road to recovery?
I think I'm laughing as I say this, but I think when you talk to many people in recovery, there's this level of serendipity that happens around the issues. And, you know, they often talk about that there's no kind of coincidences in life. So as I was really experiencing a tremendous amount problems. You know, I actually met someone who is in recovery who really understood the path that I was in. And again, you know, I think back to my own experience. And, you know, even when I knew that I had a problem, I did not see, you know, a happy life on the other side of not drinking. And, you know, and despite the fact that there was, you know, a recovery community on the other side of it, I did not see it. And it wasn't until I met a number of people in recovery that I understood, you know, kind of that I could have a happy, productive life on the other side of it. So, you know, it really was this kind of confluence of events that ultimately made me want to seek help.
Do you see then addiction, whether it's to alcohol as you had, or to legal or even illegal drugs, do you see addiction as essentially following the same kind of path?
So one of the things that I think is tremendously exciting about doing this work is our scientific evidence about what we know about addiction and drug use has changed dramatically over the past 20 years. So, you know, we know that addiction is a disease of the brain. We know it's a chronic disorder. And part of our work is to treat it like a chronic disorder. You know, I always use the analogy of other diseases as it relates to how we think about substance use disorders. And, you know, I'm sure you probably heard the expression hitting bottom.
Absolutely.
That people have to hit bottom in order to for us to be ready to treat them. And, you know, if you think of other chronic diseases, we don't apply that same framework. If you have hypertension, we don't say to someone, well, let's wait till you have a heart attack before we do some level of intervention and treatment. You know, we look at prevention efforts. We look at early intervention so that we're identifying people earlier in their disease progression to be able to intervene and change the course. We want to make sure that people have access to good treatment. And so, again, I think both from a policy perspective and a programmatic, I only have to point to my own experience and the experience of other people in recovery to say where do we need to move drug policy to really frame it as a public health disorder.
Are you ending the war on drugs by doing that?
So under the Obama administration, we've never embraced a war on drug approach. And I think that this administration, you know, really has a historic track record at kind of moving away from this notion that we can solve our issues around substance use with a criminal approach to these issues. So, you know, our policy and the continued evolution of our policy really focuses on making sure that we have good prevention, treatment, recovery support services, that we're reforming our criminal justice system. And again, under this administration and under this president, you know, we really undertook some historic reforms of our criminal justice system, particularly for people with drug offenses, to move them away from the criminal justice system. You know, we have said that we can't arrest and incarcerate our way out of this problem. We know that that's not how we're going to continue to make gains to reduce drug use and its consequences in the United States.
Under the Affordable Care Act, there is money for treating drug addictions as a disease. Are there, let's say someone listening to us wants to, and they're, let's say they're hooked on heroin or something, that they want to get treatment. Are there facilities where people can go where they don't have to wait 9 months to get in? And are there trained people that can do the kinds of effective treatments that have the kinds of beneficial results that we all want?
So one of the historic gains and I think the revolution in drug policy has been the Affordable Care Act. So we know, just in terms of context, we know that substance use disorders are probably just as prevalent as diabetes. And the treatment rate for diabetes is perhaps 85 to 90%. If you look at the treatment rate for substance use disorders, it's only about 1 in 9, right? So we have this huge treatment gap. And when you look at the reasons why we have that treatment gap, one of the biggest reasons is people who don't have insurance, or people who do have insurance whose coverage hasn't supported a good treatment benefit. The Affordable Care Act changes all of that, and it basically looks at substance use disorder treatment as one of the 10 essential benefits that plans have to offer. And the other piece is that it says those benefits have to be given on par with other medical surgical benefits. So for many people who know that insurance companies for a long time had things like lifetime limits and higher copays and deductibles for accessing mental health and substance use disorder services than they did for medical surgical benefits. So when you look at those two pieces combined, it's estimated that about 60 million people in the United States will have access to a good substance use disorder benefit.
They might have the benefit, but are there the facilities? And again, are there the trained people who can provide the effective treatment these people need?
I think you raise really two good points here in terms of making sure that we have that people who do want to seek care get access to care. And so part of the administration's efforts is to really look at how do we continue to expand access to treatment. And one of the areas that I think has been tremendously underutilized has been using our medical system and using our primary care treatment system as a really great access point for substance use disorder treatment. So not only should we have good specialty treatment programs, but we also want to make sure that people are able to access care in, for instance, community health centers and through primary care physicians. So we know we have a tremendous opportunity here to expand that. The second piece that you talk about, I think, which is another significant piece of federal effort, is to make sure that we have a good, qualifying, trained workforce to support these kinds of treatment programs. So you raise, I think, some really compelling points mm-hmm. about not just making sure that people have access to care, but they have access to care by good, qualified, trained professionals.
We're almost about a minute before our break here, but again, if you're talking about 60 million people that will have access to treatment, it takes a while to train up people to provide the care, and it also takes a special kind of person who understands, even using your own life, the fact that people with addiction are going to fail and fall apart and come back and make excuses, and it takes such a long time, or it can take such a long time to actually recover.
One of the primary areas that our administration has been focusing on, and actually there's a long history in the substance use disorder world, of how can we use specialty trained peers who often have a really profound and direct connection with people who are in early recovery. So, you know, we are looking at how do we develop this peer recovery services, and so things like developing recovery coaches and peer mentors, I think, are really a significant opportunity to increase our workforce to address this expanding population.
And that's Michael Botticelli. He is the new acting director of the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy. He has a job with the name that is stuck to it called Drug Czar. And we're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. We've been talking about a public health or mental health approach to the problem of substance abuse. We'll take a very short break, get back to our conversation, open up the lines at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back.
Does your son or daughter come home drunk or high? Would you like to learn new ways of dealing with their drug or alcohol use? The Family Training Program works with parents of children aged 12 to 25 to help them maintain control of their child's drug or alcohol problem. Held in Philadelphia by the Treatment Research Institute, a supporter of WHYY. More on the Family Training Program at 877-I-WORRY-2. That's 877-I-WORRY and the number 2. Or online at iamconcerned.org.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Paying a farmer in advance to get a share of his crops is a great way to get the freshest produce. But our resident chef, Kathy Gunn, says there are risks along with rewards.
If it's a really crummy season and there's no rain, let's say, you fall with the farmer.
That story next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Fringe Arts supports WHYY. Downtown New York dance meets the 1980s Harlem Vogue scene. High school football gets gender bent by an all-female and transgendered cast. An Iranian dissident under house arrest shares his life story in a script he smuggled out of his country. It's all part of the 2014 Fringe Festival, going on now through September 21st at Fringe Arts and all over Philly. More info at fringearts.com. That's fringearts.com.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen. Late last month, the Obama administration nominated Michael Botticelli to be the acting director of the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy. He is our guest in this hour of Radio Times. And the office oversees and administers the federal drug policy. And we are, again, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Michael Botticelli, we've done a number of programs about the return of heroin and the connection between heroin and prescription painkillers, the idea that young people or people can go to their medicine cabinet, get hooked on pain pills, and then they go seeking heroin because it's cheaper and sometimes even more available. What can be done to deal with this problem?
So you raise what is perhaps the most pressing issue that our office is dealing with right now, is the epidemic of prescription drug misuse that we have in the United States. So according to a study from the CDC that was just released, we are now prescribing enough prescription pain medication to give every adult American a bottle of pain pills. And that is, and we know the consequences of that vast overprescribing. We have always supported a balanced strategy of making sure that people who are in pain, particularly in chronic pain, have access to good care. But we have seen the pendulum swing so far in the other direction, and we're seeing the negative consequences attached to that. So CDC has classified the prescription drug misuse issue here as an epidemic. And one of the areas where we know people start on their course to addiction often comes from the medicine cabinet. 70% of people who try prescription pain medication for the first time are getting them free from friends and family. And, you know, we talk about this being epidemic of the medicine cabinet. So, you know, you get a prescription from your doctor, whether you need it or not. You might take three pills of a 30-day supply and you put it in your medicine cabinet, or you're giving it to friends and family. And we know that that often starts, the diversion from the medicine cabinet is often a place where people start. Just last week, as part of our strategy that we released in 2011 to deal with this, we actually just announced a new rule that will allow for more systemic, convenient, and environmentally friendly way for people to get these drugs out of their medicine cabinets and out of their homes. So we know that this is a significant issue.
Well, part of the problem then, of course, are doctors over-prescribing pain pills and pharmaceutical companies perhaps over-marketing them to the public.
One of the pieces of our strategy that we released in 2011 to deal with this epidemic, the first pillar of that strategy calls for education on the part of prescribers to prescribe these drugs safely. Physicians get very little training around addiction in general, and particularly around pain prescribing. So we want to make sure that prescribers are prescribing these drugs safely, that they know who might be at risk. You know, I go back to, you know, my own story, and one of my medical providers who knew I was in recovery, who knew at that time I was the director in Massachusetts for substance abuse services, after a procedure asked me if I wanted a prescription for Percocets, which are, and you know, it was a teachable moment for me to say to him that I am not the person who should be getting these medications, and or to really have a more viable pain plan. So one of the things that we've done in partnership with the National Institute of Drug Abuse is done training, online training that's free for prescribers to take some continuing medical education credits to make sure that we're prescribing these drugs safely. So the other piece, and you began to talk about this, that as people's addiction takes hold of prescription pain medication, that we know that they can often lead to more significant and other substances as a result of their addiction. And part of that transition that we've seen with a small percentage of people who are misusing pain medication has been the transition to heroin. And we've seen that in different parts of the country than historically have seen heroin. And quite honestly, a younger demographic of people. One of the astounding consequences and truly tragic consequences related to prescription drug misuse and heroin use has been the level of drug overdoses that we've seen here in the United States.
Well, in fact, the CDC, you referenced that recent report out today in 2011, something like 17,000 deaths from opioid pain relievers, and that's three times as many as deaths from heroin and cocaine.
That's correct. And so sometimes these numbers become kind of hard for me and other people to digest. And the way that I frame it for me is that we have, according to the last year that we have federal data, 110 Americans are dying every day of a drug overdose. As you indicate, almost half of that is overdoses on prescription pain medication, and a rising tide, but less significant than prescription pain medication, has been the increase in heroin-related overdose deaths. Part of our strategy to address that, we obviously want a comprehensive strategy. We want people to access treatment. But we also know we need to keep people alive to get them into treatment. And we have been promoting the use of a remarkable drug called naloxone, which has long been used by first responders to reduce an overdose. But we also know that people generally don't use alone, that often police, fire departments are first on scene, and we have been promoting the expansion of use of naloxone, particularly by first responders. And we've seen a tremendous amount of interest and utilization by state and local law enforcement to embrace naloxone. When I was in Massachusetts, we trained the first police force in the country, a small town south of Boston that had high rates of overdoses. And, since that time, we have seen many state and local police forces really embrace the use of naloxone to reverse overdose deaths.
Following up on that, let's say a police officer uses naloxone and save someone who's overdosing on heroin, would they then go and arrest them once they recover?
No. One of the other areas that we have been promoting has been state legislation, what's called Good Samaritan laws. And so we now see about 22 states across the country that have embraced Good Samaritan laws. We know one of the reasons that people don't call 911 in the event of an overdose to report it is they're often afraid of getting arrested because of paraphernalia or illicit substances. And so we have really been promoting Good Samaritan laws. And what they do is provide limited immunity for people who are reporting an overdose so they are not arrested in terms of them, the people who are overdosing or the people who are reporting. So, we don't think that overdoses are the time to be arresting people as a result of their drug use. So we have been tremendously heartened by the number of states that have implemented legislation to give limited immunity for those people who are reporting an overdose.
And that's Michael Botticelli. He's the acting director of the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy. In fact, joining us from the White House, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. And you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Let me get a couple of callers in. Looks like we have Kevin from Philadelphia joining us on Radio Times. Hi, Kevin. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, I want to just commend the director for what he's saying about saving lives and the remarkable leadership on health. It's a real breath of fresh air and a real move away from a punitive approach, which is helpful. But my question relates to the substance that often gets overlooked, even though it's, the vast majority of illegal drug users are using this substance, and that's marijuana. And I wanted to see what the director thinks, given the role of marijuana, first of all, in mental illness, but also if you speak to parents who have lost kids to heroin, they'll all tell you, 100% of them, that their childhood starts by injecting heroin in their veins. They started with drugs like alcohol and marijuana that they thought were much more mild and led them down to this path. So just wanted to, given the policy changes, where we are on this issue.
No, fair enough. And Michael Botticelli, I have a couple of follow-up questions for that as well. But what is the Obama administration's policy vis-a-vis marijuana?
Sure. So, one of the things that I think has been important for us is, we are not satisfied with the status quo, particularly as it relates to the disproportionality within our criminal justice system as it relates to drug possession. That said, I think your caller has hit some very important points that need to be raised in terms of why the administration is opposed to legalization efforts. And first and foremost is his point that drug use and addiction often starts from a very young age. And, I haven't talked to many people who are addicted to pain medication or heroin. Some are, but the vast majority of them started at a very young age, and often with alcohol, tobacco, and marijuana, often in combination. So we know that this is a disease of early onset. The second piece of this, I think, really speaks to what we know right now about the public health harms of marijuana. So while we've made some significant gains in terms of reducing youth tobacco use, youth alcohol use, and reductions in other substances, we see some really alarming trends as it relates to marijuana. So we now have more youth who are using marijuana than they do tobacco. One of the things that we track is what we call the perception of risk. So we know that one of the reasons why people use drugs is their perception of risk. So if they see something as risky, they're less likely to try it. If they see it as less risky, they're more likely to try it. So right now, youth perception of risk of marijuana use is at its all-time low level. And if you track back for 25 years and look at this perception of risk phenomena, you see an inverse relationship between perception of risk and increased use. So we know that part of the challenge and part of the message that particularly youth get when they're hearing this effort around legalization is that this substance is benign and it doesn't have the health consequences that we know come with particularly youth use of marijuana.
And let me follow up on that. And even using alcohol as an example, I mean, I think we can all agree we don't want young people drinking or using drugs, either legal or illegal. I mean, legal, obviously, if they are prescribed. But isn't it possible at this point to create a policy that, and even looking at what's happening in Washington and Oregon as a kind of a laboratory, to see if it's possible to allow adults who don't have addiction problems to smoke marijuana, but also send a message to young people with their evolving and developing brains to say, this is something that you should not be doing. Can't we come up with a message that says that?
So I think if we look at things like tobacco and alcohol, one of the things that we know, I've been doing public health work for a long time, and, if we look at the commercialization of marijuana in Colorado and Washington, I think there is significant and legitimate concern that these substances are despite, the most robust regulatory scheme that you can put in place, are going to lead toward increased youth use. So alcohol is a, heavily regulated substance, but we know that we, even though we've made gains, have a significant amount of underage drinking. When you look at industry practice, particularly in the tobacco industry, part of their strategy has been to, one, market to youth, to really market to communities of color and to poor underserved. So I think we have ample evidence and ample cause for concern to say that even in the most kind of highly regulated market, that we can prevent increased youth use.
But I wonder whether, because you have a boss, we have a president who smoked marijuana as a youth. I'm going to quote something that he said in The New Yorker. He said, as has been well documented, I smoked pot as a kid, and I view it as a bad habit and vice, not very different from the cigarettes that I smoked as a young person up through a big chunk of my adult life. I don't think it's more dangerous than alcohol. Maybe we should not be locking up kids or individual users for long stretches of jail time when some of the folks who are writing those laws have probably done the same. same thing. This is a complicated issue, but it seems that when you have the President of the United States who used marijuana and didn't have a problem with it because he's not hooked on it, as far as I know, I know he's not hooked on it today, in terms of getting out a message, it's so easy to be called a hypocrite, if you know what I mean.
I think the president, when you look at the totality of his comments, even beyond that quote, was really referencing the disproportionality in our criminal justice system, which is part and parcel of our strategy. He also said that as a father, he wouldn't promote it with his daughters, and that we need to focus our efforts on a public health strategy. I think that's why he nominated me for this position, and I think it's entirely comports with our national drug control strategy.
But at the same, so here's what I guess it gets difficult, which is that if you want to have this public health approach, it does mean then moving away from a more law enforcement approach. And I'm looking at some statistics about just who's incarcerated in this country. About half of the people, I believe these are in federal prisons, are there for drug offenses. You referenced this earlier. I mean, are we going to see a shift, I guess, in funding and in real direction when it comes to drugs, especially when it comes to marijuana?
I think we've already begun to see that shift in trend. So when you look at our national drug control budget, we are actually spending more now on prevention, treatment, and recovery than we do on domestic law enforcement. That level of public health support for these interventions is at its highest level in 12 years. So, we've seen reductions over the past couple years in as it relates to our prison population. We have been supporting a wide variety of interventions to move people away from the criminal justice system. So things like diversion courts and drug courts that move people away from incarceration as it relates to their drug offenses. I think much of the work that the Attorney General has been promoting around Smart on Crime initiatives has been a sea change in how we think about people, low-level, nonviolent offenders who are intersecting with our criminal justice system. I really get heartened when I talk to many, many local law enforcement officers who echo that we can't arrest our way out of the problem. So, I will be the first to say that we have a long way to go, but I will also be the first to say that we have made a significant amount of progress in reframing and reforming drug policy as a public health-related issue.
And about a minute before another break, but even going back to your own personal story, as I understand it, you were given a choice by a judge. Do you want to go to jail? Do you want to go to treatment? You chose treatment.
I was given that choice, and I think that we know that people often intersect with the criminal justice system, and it really provides, quite honestly, a significant intervention opportunity. When you have a judge in front of you saying, would you like to go to jail or would you like to go to treatment, we know that treatment doesn't need to be entirely voluntary to be effective. But we also know, Marty, and I think this is a really important point, that part of the reason that people are intersecting with our criminal justice system has been because of that treatment gap, that because people don't have adequate insurance coverage, that they haven't had access to care. And it's been unfortunate that, quite honestly, our criminal justice system has been our de facto substance use treatment system. So I think having good access to care will also help in terms of keeping people away from the criminal justice system.
Another short break, and we'll get back to our conversation with Michael Botticelli, acting director of the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy. He's stuck with the name Drug Czar. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation and our callers at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The American Philosophical Society Museum invites visitors to remember where it all began, to view Jefferson's handwritten draft of the Declaration of Independence, and to discover what the city of brotherly love was really like during the Revolutionary War. Jefferson's Guide to Philadelphia provides a view of your city and its history through new eyes. Jefferson, Philadelphia, and the Founding of a Nation, now through December. To learn more, APSmuseum.org. The APS Museum supports WHYY.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Lawrence Wright. His new book is about the peace agreement between Egypt and Israel that was brokered by President Carter at Camp David. Wright is also the author of The Looming Tower, about the history of Al-Qaeda, and Going Clear, Scientology, Hollywood, and the Prison of Belief. Join us. this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
One of the components in virtually all modern electronic gadgets, worker exploitation.
China had had to create some clinics just for the paralyzed teenagers and kids who'd fallen into comas from the toxic chemicals that they'd been exposed to in the factories.
The cost of being the manufacturing leader in electronics, a human cost in China. That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Michael Botticelli. He's the acting director of the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy. And we've been talking about how he wants to bring a more public health, less criminal justice approach to drug policy here in the United States. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Let me get Rebecca from Villanova to join us on Radio Times. Rebecca, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
I'm a grad student, and I work in a laboratory that does addiction research, and funding is just really hard to come by. NIH grants are far and few between, and just funding in general is really been down lately. And I know a lot of that is a function of the economy, but I was wondering if there were any plans to increase the availability of funding for addiction research, given how beneficial it can be in the long term for creating the newest interventions and the understanding of the neurological ways that addiction works.
Rebecca, thanks for the call. Michael Botticelli, go ahead.
So I think your caller raises a tremendously important point. And, you know, as I indicated, you know, one of the things that really has helped inform our national drug control strategy has been science and evidence. And we know how critically important that can be to do that. It's been a tremendously challenging fiscal environment here in Washington. But clearly, you know, our strategy calls for continued resources as it relates to research to make sure that our policies and practices line up against that current evidence.
I have an email here I'm going to read from Anne. She says, delighted to see a person in recovery in a drug leadership role, exclamation point. After 3 rehabs for alcohol and heroin, my son is doing well. However, we belong to a parent support group that has 40 to 50 parents every Thursday night. We've lost 2 of our children in the last 3 weeks. This is the generation's equivalent of AIDS. It's not a criminal issue. It's medical addiction. Just picking up on what we were talking about earlier. But, you know, what a tragedy to lose so many children.
It's really hard for me, Marty, to even wrap my head around the number of people that we're losing to overdoses. And, you know, part of the really painful part about my job, but the necessary part of my job, is to really engage with the people like the parent who emailed you. Part of my job is to continue to meet with parents, to hear their stories, to hear what more we can do to prevent drug overdoses that are happening here in the U.S. We've been tremendously supportive of parent support groups as a way to provide a level of support and understanding for this work that's happening. As I want to make sure that we are putting faces and names to our sons and daughters who are overdosing, I think it's particularly important. You know, I'm an open gay man who lived and worked through the AIDS epidemic. And there are so many parallels that we see in terms of diminishing the shame and stigma of calling out names and faces of people who have died. So there are significant parallels between what we experienced during the AIDS epidemic and what we're experiencing now.
Let me get Paul from Hamilton to join us. Paul, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi there.
This is Paul. I'm enjoying this conversation tremendously. My son died from a drug overdose July of 2010.
I'm so sorry.
And I'm very active. I'm a strong advocate. And I live in New Jersey, and recently the Governor Christie, passed the Overdose Prevention Act, May 2nd, 2013, and didn't really get started. The implementation didn't really get rolling until this year. And in 3 to 4 months, we've had approximately 150 saves, save being someone who overdosed and was treated with Narcan or Naloxone. So I guess my point is that Mr. Botticelli has a great deal of knowledge, a very strong feeling for solving this problem. But yet, as time passes, there's more and more deaths, and we can't seem to get our hands around this. And I believe it's purely a result of insufficient treatment.
Well, Paula, first of all, we're so sorry to hear what happened with your son, and appreciate the call to Radio Times. You raised several questions or comments. One is this naloxone that you had mentioned earlier, Michael Botticelli, and I guess just how effective that is in preventing overdose. Obviously, you're dealing with someone with a serious drug problem, but nonetheless, it prevents them from dying from it.
So, you know, my heart goes out to Paul. For his loss, and really appreciate his advocacy. Parents have played such a critical role in continued advocacy, primarily at the state level, in ensuring that New Jersey and other states around the country have really good overdose prevention laws. So in addition to Good Samaritan laws, we now have 26 states across the country who have been implementing some level of overdose prevention legislation. But Paul is entirely right that part of the situation that we're in requires access, timely access to good treatment. And again, I can't underscore the importance enough of the Affordable Care Act in getting access to good treatment. I'm sure Paul probably experienced, like many parents I hear from, about trying to get access to care and only to be found that because of insurance status, there wasn't services available for their sons or daughters. Or the other story that I hear is parents who've had to mortgage their house to because their insurance didn't support good comprehensive treatment. So that's why the Affordable Care Act and the implementation of the Addiction Parity Act become incredibly consequential in our quest to reduce overdoses in the United States.
Paul, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call us well. And again, that phone number 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at WHYY. Radio Times. And again, our guest is Michael Botticelli. He's the acting director of the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy, the Drug Czar, and he is a recovering alcoholic, which makes him unusual for a job of this kind of stature. I wonder, too, as you said, you come from a family where there are alcoholics and there seems to be some kind of genetic component, but it's also true that some people turn to addiction as a result of trauma. For young people, the victims of sexual abuse will, as adults or even teenagers, turn to drugs or alcohol to try to mitigate some of the pain that they feel because of what has happened to them, which raises questions about intervening early and preventing this addiction from taking hold for someone who's obviously been through a great deal of difficulty.
Marty, you articulated what we know to be some of the risk factors associated for why people start using drugs and why they become addicted. So first of all, we know that genetics plays a significant role, and it's estimated that about, you know, it accounts for about 50% of the problem. But we know that there are other risk factors involved. And you articulated one of the main ones that we know to be the case, that trauma, particularly early childhood trauma, plays a significant role in what someone's trajectory is, both in terms of their mental health issues and their substance use issues, and often a combination of both mental health and substance use issues. So we know, and what historically our healthcare system hasn't been doing a good job at, is that level of early intervention. And how do we make sure that we're screening people, not just for health conditions, but some of the other conditions in their life, specifically trauma and early childhood adverse events, to make sure that we're monitoring people so that they don't develop a significant mental health and substance use disorder. On the other side of it is treatment and making sure that we have good, competent treatment. And largely as an effort of our Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, we have been implementing what we're calling trauma-informed care, so that we know, particularly for women, who many of whom have histories of trauma in their life, are getting good, competent care that addresses not only their substance use disorder, but also their histories of trauma.
Let me get Colleen from Mullica Hill, New Jersey, to join us. Hi, Colleen. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, hi.
Hi there.
I'm enjoying this very much also.
Thanks.
And I would just like to comment. I've been a nurse practitioner in the emergency room for about 22 years, and I've seen the numbers of people, wanting narcotics and controlled substances really explode. But what I mostly worry about is the fact that also under the Affordable Care Act, hospitals have been starting to get reimbursement partially based on evaluations. And it puts us in a very difficult spot because we, want to relieve people's pain. We don't want to see anyone in pain. We're also under pressure not to overprescribe, which, is something that I try to stick to. But then on the other hand, people come to the hospital because they're out of their medicines, they, need more medicine, they don't get their drugs, they're out of their heroin, they want some opioids instead. And if you don't give them any medicines, they fill out the evaluations, and then they get, oh, they didn't take care of me, my satisfaction score is low, things like that. So it's a double-edged sword. I was wondering if you could comment on that.
Sure.
And the other part,
well, you know what, Colleen, only because that's such an interesting point, and I want to give Michael Botticelli a chance to raise that about hospitals being caught between, a satisfied or a dissatisfied customer when it comes to drugs.
Colleen raises a incredibly valuable point here about, one, appreciate her efforts as a nurse practitioner to do the right thing as it relates to prescribing within the emergency departments. One of the efforts that we've been undertaking as part of our strategy has been the implementation and use of what we call prescription drug monitoring databases. And these allow prescribers, whether it's in the emergency department, to query these databases to see if the person in front of them is searching for medications by going to more than one doctor or more than one pharmacist. So that's the front end of the issue that Colleen was referring to. The second piece is something that has been recently called to our attention that we have to focus on. And what she's referring to is that hospitals, as part of their evaluation around their work with the Affordable Care Act, is this incentive about how clients are seen, what's their satisfaction level seen as it relates to their pain prescribing. And what we don't want to have in place is this perverse incentive where Colleen tries to do the right thing by not giving a person in front of her a prescription pain medication when they don't need it. We don't want her or that hospital to be dinged from a financial standpoint because they're doing the right thing. So, she articulates some work that we yet have to do as it relates to what are the incentives and how do we measure that adequate treatment of pain.
Colleen, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let's see what Tony from Philadelphia has to say. Tony, you're on Radio Times. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you.
You're welcome.
Hear so much about the victims and the people using it, but what is being done to stop the drugs from coming in, and who, what money is being put toward arresting the big people? There's somebody out there, lots of people, who are bringing all of this stuff in. What's the administration's position?
Indeed. Michael Botticelli, go ahead.
So, part of what we look at with a national drug control strategy is this intersection and nexus between supply and demand. So from a public health standpoint, we know that the more available something is, particularly drugs, the more likely people are to use them. And one only has to think about the heroin situation to really understand this nexus between supply and demand. Part of the issue why we're seeing increased rates of heroin in the United States is because we have very pure, very cheap, very available heroin in many parts of the country where we haven't seen it before. And when you look at that kind of the other part of the drug control strategy, it's really about how do we diminish harmful substances from our community. I've been doing public health work for a long time, and reducing the supply of bad substances in our community has always been one of the underpinnings of our public health strategy. And the same is true with drug use. So a lot of our strategy focuses on working with some of our international partners, working with law enforcement in other countries and in the United United States to reduce the availability of these substances within our communities.
Tony, thanks for the call to Radio Times. A couple of minutes before we have to say goodbye, we haven't really talked about education, but what do you think is a good way to educate, especially young people, about the dangers of drugs? And we know what's been tried in the past, some more effective than others. What's effective? Do we know yet?
We do. And so we actually, this is where science has really helped us to think about how we implement good evidence-based programs, particularly prevention programs. And if you look on our website and other websites, they will have what are evidence-based prevention programs. And you're entirely right, Marty. You know, historically in the past, we've used scare tactics. We've used a wide variety of practices in previous administrations to really look at ways to prevent drug use. But we know how to do it. And we have evidence-based prevention programs that are working, are effective. One of the main programs that our office supports are drug-free communities. So we have about 800 drug-free communities across the United States who are implementing evidence-based programs. And independent evaluations show that these communities who have implemented these evidence-based programs have seen reduced substance use by youth in their communities. So we know what works. We know how to evaluate it. And we need to continue those efforts to prevent drug use before it starts.
And if you're talking to teenagers, don't you need to be honest?
You do need to.
Because they have, you know, they have antenna for that stuff.
So one of the prime prevention strategies that we and other parts of the federal government have been supporting is for parents to, one, be good role models, and second, to have open, candid conversations with their kids about what their expectations are and what the consequences of drug use. So based on data, we know only about 50% of parents are having discussions with their children about what their expectations are around substance use. And so one of the simplest ways that we can make headway is by parents have good, open, honest conversations with their children.
Well, on that note, Michael Botticelli, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times.
It's my pleasure.
And he's acting director of the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy. In fact, joined us from the White House in this hour of Radio Times. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out much more about this program, including Facebook and Twitter and stuff like that. Stay with us. We'll be right back.